Welcome. I'm glad you're here. Thank you for taking this journey with us as a church through all of the changes and new unique things. It's all awkward. It's all strange. It's all new. It's all, and we don't know where it lands right at the end of the day, but it'll land somewhere and the Lord's doing some new things. So we're just really glad you're here. Thank you for taking the journey with us. Secondly, I don't know who that person was in your life. I have several that come to my mind who carried great authority, probably my dad, number one. Now, we never, eventually we figure out that no one's perfect, right, in life. And so you learn that as an adult about other people. But the incredible influence that they had and the good things that they bring to the table. So you've got those people in your lives, both historically and personally, and so do I. And one of those is a really good friend in California named Chuck. He's a guy that I just admire. I love. Carries great authority because of the way, not only what he says, but the way he lives. Even though he's in bed by 8:30 every night, which is a little strange, but he still is very influential in my life. So we're glad you're here, and we're talking about authority is really what we're talking about. We're going to periodically walk our way through the book of the Gospel of Matthew, and the Gospel of Matthew is all about the kingdom. And in this whole process, we looked at the Sermon on the Mount, which is this incredible expression of authority as Jesus addressed all sorts of powerful and interesting issues. And the way he did it astounded people with the way he presented himself and what he said. He spoke with incredible authority. And then in the chapters after that, chapters 8 and 9, he's going to talk about and reveal things of authority that Jesus did. And because authority is really that, is his power and the right and the responsibility to give orders, make decisions, and enforce obedience. Now, that sounds kind of, when we talk about enforcing obedience, I don't know about you, but almost everybody I know, and it's human, their skin begins to crawl just a little bit. They're like, we don't really actually like to be obedient, you know, and to enforce obedience, we're like, oh, I don't want that, and we begin to push back. And that is the history of mankind, that we begin to push back from that. And sometimes we push back from inappropriate power that enforces obedience, but sometimes we also push back from appropriate power and that we need to be obedient to. And that's kind of the history of man. So in Matthew 8 and 9, it's going to reveal the authority that Jesus possessed and demonstrated in all sorts of areas, over disease and over death, over nature and over nations. And we're also going to see over the demonic and over the disciples. And the real question is this, is over you and over me. It's the application, right? You think, okay, who was this man named Jesus? What did he say? What did he do? And what does it have to do with me? And does he possess and does he demonstrate power in my life and authority in my life? That's what we're going to have to decide. And I think it's this, that for today, Matthew 8 and 9 reveals that authority that he possessed and demonstrated. And it has to be described and defined since time began. And in the salvation history, now that's kind of a religious thing to say, right? Okay, salvation history. Here's what it means. It is God's redemptive work and God's redemptive plan since day one. What's he been doing? Now, you guys, the history of the world's pretty long. And there was a lot of the history of the world even before the life of Christ. What was God doing to redeem man? Because we know in chapter 3 of Genesis, things got all messed up. And instead of God just saying, you guys drive me nuts, you know, why don't you just go away? And if you won't go away, then I'm going to go away. And so we'll just call this thing off, right? Well, the reality is that God said, I'm going to do redemptive things. I'm going to bring this back together. I'm going to create reconciliation. And he said, okay, what did that look like? Did people just kind of exist until the time of Christ and God was doing nothing? And he's done something then and ever since? Or was he doing something before that? We call that salvation history. It is God's redemptive work and plan that he's been doing. And today, we're going to look at it even in the prophet Isaiah, approximately 700 BC. That God was doing something that mattered. And you'll see it in this passage. So let's just jump into the passage first. We're going to look at Matthew chapter 8. Verses 14, 15, 16, 17. So it's pretty short, right? So this will be a short sermon. You'll be able to get home pretty quickly, all right? So let's just start, and we'll see how short it might be. So look in verse 14. It says, and when Jesus entered Peter's house. Okay, let's stop there just for a second. and say, okay, what's going on here? He enters into Peter's house. Well, where did Peter live? What did Peter do? I've got some pictures for you. We did a real estate, you know, kind of a Zillow thing. And now, let me show you this first one. This is the Jewish synagogue in Capernaum, okay? So this is the synagogue that a few verses before this, we know that the Roman centurion came to Jesus and said, hey, will you heal my servant? And my servant's at home. He's really sick. And he goes, well, okay, and let's go. And the guy says, hey, you don't even need to go. I mean, I'm a man of authority. I understand. I have servants under me. I have people that obey me when I command. All you have to do, Jesus, is command it done. You don't even need to go. And Jesus says, I have never even found this kind of faith in all of Israel. And it's among a Roman, a centurion. And the other Jewish leaders were very supportive of this because they say, this is the guy who had built the synagogue. He financed it. This is the synagogue that he built. They've unearthed it. It's been excavated. This is the synagogue in Capernaum. And then, interestingly enough, just south of this, just a stone's throw south of this, there was a 5th century Byzantine church that had been built. And it was built over what was believed to be Peter's house. Actually, it was Andrew's house too, his brother. They lived in mom and dad's place. And it was big enough for their two families and the parents to live there. And so it was just south of the synagogue. And here's a picture of it. It's an octagon deal. And as they began to excavate this, in 1968, they unearthed this underneath that octagon church. Now, the modern church in the background there is an actual church, but this is Peter's house and Andrew's house. It had two kind of outdoor courtyards around which it was built. They found that some of the rooms were even plastered, which is very odd. Plastered inside, and there were sayings in there about Jesus the Christ, and in fact, three places where they found the name of Peter on these walls, and they think this was where Peter and Andrew lived. This is where Jesus went with Peter to his own house. Now, look, here's a picture of the proximity of the two. We have Peter's house in the foreground, and the synagogue in the background. So it was right there. It's amazing. So maybe when he had healed the Roman centurion's servant, he may have gone directly with Peter to his house. And this is what it looked like. Now, I'm kind of a history buff, so I just love these pictures, right? So I hope they encourage you too. But let's go back to the passage. It says, when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. Now, you guys, this opens it up to all those jokes, right? All those mother-in-law jokes, of which I'm not going to do, right? Because it would be funny, but they're really not funny at the end of the day. Because that, behind every successful man is a very devoted wife and a surprised mother-in-law, you know? Or some of the others that are not so great, okay? But here we go. He saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever, and he touched her hand, and the fever left her. And she rose and began to serve him. That evening, and by way of implication, probably happened right here in Peter's house, which for the next 150 years acted as a house church. For 150 years, this is where the believers of Capernaum would come together in Peter's house. And so he touched, that evening, they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons. And he cast out the spirits with a word, and he healed all who were sick. And then look at verse 17. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. And so he quotes the prophet. And he says that he took our illnesses and bore our diseases. Now, let's isolate that. Let's isolate that passage, that verse. Okay? Like, okay, that's a weird thing to say. Sort of, kind of, right? Now, look at this. It's a quote of Isaiah 53, verse 4. Okay? Now, I have a question before we go there, is how did Matthew know this? Matthew makes the comment that this was to fulfill what was spoken by Isaiah. How did he know that? Well, there's only a couple of answers, I think. One is that Matthew could have been, and probably was, pretty schooled in the scriptures. Isaiah is the most quoted prophet in the New Testament. His prophecies and his writings were incredibly influential. It had influenced the way that Israel functioned. And people began to look back to that. The people were looking for deliverance. And that is a big theme in the writings of Isaiah, okay? And they were feeling the pressure. They were dominated by the Romans. They were controlled by them. They hated it. They wanted out from underneath of that. And they were looking for deliverance. And so the prophet Isaiah was very apropos for them. And so they began to really think about it a lot. And here, maybe Matthew was schooled in the scriptures. Probably was. But is it also possible that maybe Jesus had said, after these events, as he sat down with his disciples, and we don't know, it's not recorded, but did Jesus say, hey, you guys, I want you to understand, the things that I've been doing, this is to fulfill the words of Isaiah, the prophet, who had been anticipating my coming, even though that many years before. God had motivated him and had inspired him as a prophet to be able to begin to tell about the future. I've been fulfilling the things of Isaiah. Maybe that's how he knew. I don't know for sure. But somehow Matthew knew this was in fulfillment of what Isaiah had said. Now, you guys, let's just think about it for a second. What if God's redemptive work has an integrated synthetic element to it that has been going on since Genesis chapter 3, probably even before that, and God understanding the fallenness of the world. But he says, what if he's been weaving this together for thousands of years? He knew what was going on. He was doing something. He was doing something amazing. What if God was preparing them? And you guys, let's take that same question and let's bring it to today. What if God is doing something in our world today? In you and me and around us and throughout the whole world. And not that we understand it all the time. The people of the Old Testament didn't understand every piece in every way. It was a progressive revelation. What if he's still doing that? And that where you sit today, where you live today, God is still at work doing something. As a whole in our world, as a part in the United States, in a smaller part in St. Louis, and an even smaller part in you. What if God is still at work? What if he's doing something? I think that's what's going on here. And so we're going to look at Isaiah. Let's look over it really quickly. Isaiah 53, verse 4. So here's the part that Matthew quotes, okay? So here in verse 4, it says, surely thou, this black part here, he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Now let me just finish the verse. Yet we consider him punished by God and stricken by him and afflicted. Now, this verse sits in a context, right? Every text has a context. So what was Isaiah doing here? So let's talk just briefly. Isaiah was a prophet, approximately 700 BC. He was primarily a prophet to Judah, which is the southern portion of Israel. Remember, the 12 tribes had had a civil war. The 10 tribes in the north decided to be Israel. The two in the south, which was Judah and Benjamin, they decided to be Judah. And there was a great division in the people of Israel. And both sides, on the most part, walked away from God. And they didn't do much. And God sent prophets, including Isaiah, to basically say this, either shape up or ship out. That's what God's doing. And so in the prophet Isaiah, there's two main parts. The first 39 verses is about judgment. There's a little bit of hope in there, but on the most part, it's about judgment. He says, if you don't change, if you keep walking away from God, God isn't going to do nothing. He's going to do something. And there was judgment for Judah, for those two tribes. There was judgment for the nations in chapters 13 to 23. And there was judgment for the rise and the fall of Jerusalem itself, the Mount Zion, the city of God. And there was going to be judgment for that. That goes from 24 to 39. But also, it wasn't just about judgment. It was about hope. But in between, we find the exile to Babylon. You see, finally, he exiled them. It was a huge issue. And he exiles them to Babylon. Now, by the time that happens, Isaiah's dead. He has prophesied about these things that God had motivated him and inspired him to show him all that was going to happen. And so then in chapters 40 through 66, it's about hope. There's a little bit of judgment in there, but it's about hope. It's about hope for Jerusalem. It's about hope through the servant. We'll come back to that. And it was about hope to the nations. You see, God is a God who is holy, but he is a God who is redemptive. And that's same in our lives. He is holy and he is redemptive. If God was only holy, I would be toast. I would be done with. Isn't that what Isaiah felt? When he understood the holiness of God, he said, I am so unholy. I am so messed up. God touches him. Makes a difference. Does a redemptive work. It's amazing in there. And he's also redemptive to the nations. See, God has a plan, and he's been unfolding it since the beginning of time, and he hasn't finished yet. And guess what? He hasn't finished with you. He has a redemptive plan for you. It's an incredible thought. And so that's kind of Isaiah. So let's circle this thing called the servant. In chapters 49 to 55, he's talking about the servant. And tell you the truth, Jewish scholars have wrestled for the last several thousand years with who is this servant? What is this servant? Is it the nation of Israel itself? Is it a person? Is it a concept? Is it a divine individual? Is it a human individual? They've been struggling with this, trying to fit it together, trying to understand who it is that this is this servant. Okay? So in the middle of that section, we get Isaiah 53, verse 4. Let's go there. But you think it's got to sit in a context, and here's the context. It goes from 52:13 to 53:12. I'm just going to read it. Now listen to this, because it begins to describe this person called the servant. And they didn't know exactly who this was. But now looking back, and for the disciples looking back, after, especially after the crucifixion and the resurrection, does this sound maybe like Jesus is 700 years before the servant was being anticipated? Look at this. We'll go quickly. 52, verse 13. See, my servant will act wisely, and he will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Just as there are many who were appalled by him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond human likeness. You guys, when we really understand the crucifixion and what happened to Christ, he was beaten beyond recognition. If you've seen The Passion of the Christ, though as brutal as it is, it was much closer to the truth than all those other movies we've seen about Jesus, of how he was beaten, how he was whipped. So brutally that you could probably see his internal organs on his back. Verse 15, so he will sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. That the nations will begin to get a concept of who Jesus really was, or who this servant really was. Look at this in verse 1 then of chapter 53. Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. The scriptures tell us that Jesus wasn't this, you know, middle linebacker football figure. You know, this good-looking guy with flowing hair. It says that he was not all that impressive by way he looks, right? But they had no majesty, no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Wow. Whoever this servant is, it's amazing. Look at this in verse 4. Surely he took our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. A lot of people at the crucifixion of Christ said he deserved it. He was a rebel. He was a liar. He claimed to be God. He's crazy. He's a nut. He's causing more trouble than anything he's worth. He was stricken by God, is what it looked like. Verse 5. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds, we are healed. Wow. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Matthew understood this. Eventually, he understood this Christ, this Jesus, this one that I've been following. He is the fulfillment of Isaiah 53. Look at this in verse 7. He was oppressed, and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shears is silent, so he did not open his mouth. But oppression and judgment he was taken away. Yet who of his generation protested? He was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. Verse 9, he was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich of his death, He was buried in a tomb of the rich people. It's amazing what happened. And though he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. That will not be the end of being crushed. He will, in a sense, something good's going to happen at the end of it. Look at this in verse 11. After he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Is that an amazing description? Just think of it, you guys. 700 BC, Isaiah sees this coming. He prophesies it. He describes this servant. That's an amazing thought. You see, the Jews were looking for a deliverer. In the time of Jesus, they were tired of the oppression, and they were looking for a deliverer. They wanted a divine deliverer who would take the Romans away and set them free. But they didn't understand that the deepest need in their heart was for someone to take on their iniquity, take on their sin. I don't know about you, but I think I feel the same way. I feel the same way. I want someone to take all the messed up world and take it away. Fix it. Take all this nuttiness that we live among. Take it away. And I think Jesus says, Kevin, I'd love to do that, and I will someday. Someday I'm going to come back. I'm coming back and you will not miss it. It is going to be obvious. I will come as a divine deliverer and I will conquer the world in an incredible way. Revelation chapter 1, chapter 17, chapter 21. You can go there and you can see this description of the way he's going to come back. But to begin that process, Kevin, I need to come and I need to die for you. Do you not understand that, Kevin? I need to give my life for you. I need to be a suffering servant who will give myself for you, because your heart is so broken and messed up and sinful and dark. I have to come for that first. And that's what he did. And then I'll come back again someday. These two comings of Christ. I'll come victoriously on a white horse, in robes on which the robes of my thigh will be written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. My eyes will be brilliant, and I'll have a sword as a tongue, and I will take over once and for all. But first, I have to come to die for you, Kevin. If you were the last person on earth, the last human being alive, I'd still come just for you and die for you. Wow. So let's go back to Matthew. Matthew chapter 8, verses 14 to 17. And we've ended here with, It was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. That's why I came. This very first time. Wow. Now let's go back up to verse 14. Okay, so this, to put that in context, these things happened to fulfill what was spoken by Isaiah. Okay, so now this probably reaches back beyond this in the scriptures, in the context. It probably goes back to the very beginning part of chapter 8. But in this immediate part, look at this. To fulfill that, here's what he does. So when Jesus enters Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law, Peter's mother-in-law, lying sick with a fever. Just so you know, when it says lying sick, the literal Greek word means that she was thrown onto the bed. Okay? So it's this something was really wrong. Seriously wrong. She was really, really sick. She wasn't just having a slight fever and feeling kind of sad for herself because she didn't feel great. That's not what's going on. She is in bed, and she is probably in the process of what it looks like dying. She was really sick. She'd been thrown onto the bed, and that she had this fever that was raging in her. And I would imagine that when they came into Peter's house, Peter loved his mother-in-law. And so did Jesus. But he loved her. And he said, Jesus, my mother-in-law is struggling. Could you do something? And it says this. It's very simple. He just touched her hand. You know, I don't know about you, but I'd make a bigger deal. I'd make a little bit more of a show about it if I was going to heal somebody. All he did, he goes, he touched her hand. That's it. He just touched her. That's an incredible thought. Now, for her to be this sick, it probably looks a little bit like COVID if someone in intensive care. And you don't really want to touch that person, right? You know, Gina even said last week, the doctors really didn't want to even want to come in. They came in as little as possible. Jesus has said, man, I'm going to touch her. And he just touches her. Just touches her. And the fever left her. Sometimes I just think Jesus healed people in all sorts of different ways. This one, he just touched her. I love that. And then look at this. And she rose and began to serve him. Now, that sounds a little chauvinistic, right? I mean, in one way, we kind of go, oh, wow, she has to get up and start working. I think the passage clearly is about the fact that she was so healed that she immediately was totally fine. And out of the gratefulness of her heart, she popped out of bed and she began to join the group. And she served. And she served him out of the gratefulness of her heart. I wonder if you and I understand the incredible touch of Christ and what he's done in our lives. And maybe just to serve him. To God, I want to serve you. Jesus, I want to serve you. Have you ever wondered where you stand with God? You ever asked that question? We ought to, probably. Where do I stand with God? Now, you guys, if you answer that question with anything that has to do with performance, then where you stand with God shifts every moment or every day. Sometimes you're really in good shape, right? Hey, I've been really good. I've been performing pretty well. I've been doing all the right things, feeling good about it. I spend a lot of time in the Word. I'm praying a lot. I'm good to people. I buy a lot of Girl Scout cookies. You know, I'm doing a lot, something really good here. And we're standing in good shape. And then there are those other days. And we won't describe all the details, but I don't know if you ever have a day, a week, a month, where you're kind of a knucklehead. I have those. So if you're where you stand with God is determined on your performance, then that's just legalism. Guess what? Romans 5, chapter 2, says that you stand in his grace. That's where you stand. I picture it as a big circle, a red circle that goes about 10 feet either side of me, front, back, sides. And when I move, it moves with me. It always follows you around. That's where you stand in his grace. That's how powerful the death of Christ is. That's how amazing it is for his redemptive work in your life. You stand in his grace. And if you stand in his grace, then we begin to respond to saying, you mean you love me all the time? Yeah. He goes, I do. I do. In fact, I really do. Kevin, I love you all the time. Now, sometimes you're a knucklehead. Let's just acknowledge it. But guess what? I love you in that. I died for that. And when you're good, I'm really appreciative because it's a proper response. But guess what? You stand in my grace no matter what, ever. You stand in my grace. You go, wow, it's incredible. And we maybe then say, God, I'd like to say thank you. With my heart and with my actions, I'd like to say thank you. I'd like to live there. Now, I'll probably mess up. He goes, I know, I got it. This sanctification process won't be done until the day I return. Got it. But let's walk together. I'll show you. I'll teach you how to live. I'll show you. Wow. He says he touched her hand and the fever left her and she rose and began to serve him. Maybe we could be more like Peter's mother-in-law. And then it goes on and he says, just look at this. It's so simple. One verse. You guys, we could make a whole show out of this, right? I mean, this could be a whole Hollywood series. Look at verse 16. That evening, they brought to him many, and that word many is pretty powerful. It means a lot of them. The many were oppressed by demons. The demonic world. Those fallen angels who were in opposition to God, who were trying to ruin people's lives. The demonic was there. There were ones who were even oppressed by the demons. And he cast out the spirits simply with a word. He didn't do hocus pocus. He didn't get magic pixie dust and put it over them. He just called it out and said, leave. A word. Wow. That's authority. And not only that, and all these demon-possessed, but it says also he healed all who were sick. You get this picture that they were bringing a lot of people who were sick, and he just healed them. And I'm just kind of blown away that he makes such a small deal of it. He just describes it. He says, man, with a word he cast out demons, and he healed many. He doesn't even describe how he did it. He just healed them. And now let's kind of blow it up here. For this was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and he bore our diseases. He's the one who bore it on himself. The description of the coming of Christ, this first coming, and what he did. Rejected, despised, hung on a cross, buried in a borrowed grave of a rich man. And he did it for us. And he's still doing it. Guys, Isaiah 53. He took our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds we were healed. We all, like sheep without a shepherd, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before the shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth. That's what he did for us. You guys, look at this. In Mark chapter 14, it records that at the trial before the Sanhedrin, at the end of his life, he was subject of messiahship, the being the anointed one. It's noteworthy. Jesus remained silent and gave no answer when they kept examining him. He just kept quiet, just like Isaiah 53 said. And again, the high priest asked him at the end, he said, are you the Messiah? Are you the anointed one? Are you the one we've been looking forward to, or at least the Jews have been? And he says, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? And here's what Jesus says, I am. I am the great I am. I've always been and always am and will always be. I am. And then he goes on and he says, and you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. He was describing his next coming. Wow. Look at this. In John 4, Jesus is responding to the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well in Sychar. And he says that the woman said to him, after her interaction with him, she said, I know that Messiah, called the Christ, the Anointed One, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. Now, he had just explained everything to her about her life. And Jesus said, I who speak to you am He. I am the Anointed One. Guys, God has been planning this from day one. It's in His redemptive plan. And He's still doing it. Someday He's coming back. And you and I have not left His plan. You see, Jesus spoke and acted with absolute authority, astounding the people who are around Him. Also, Jesus has all the authority in heaven and on earth. And He always has as the Son of God. Always has, from eternity past. He also, Jesus has authority that's delegated to Him by God the Father, because the Father empowered the Son of Man to be Messiah through the line of David. And also, Jesus' authority is aimed at redeeming people who know that they are broken, rather than people who are self-sufficient. And the question is, do we fit that description today? Are we the broken people that Messiah wants to touch? Just like Isaiah said, that He would die for us. And just like Peter's mother-in-law, just a touch and to heal. And that we would rise and serve to say thank you, right? I'm amazed at God's redemptive work. We get that feeling, that sense that He is weaving together something and you and I fit in it, but it has been happening from day one of creation and even before. And you and I fit in that. And here we find that even Isaiah described that process. And Jesus says, I fulfill it all. Guess what? He fulfills it all for every one of us. That's the hope that we have in our lives. So whatever's going on in your life, He's not ignorant of it. He knows what's happening in you, around you, through you, what He wants to do. Take everything in your life. I don't know if you have any messed up pieces. I do. But He's at work, and you can trust Him, because Jesus has all the authority. All right? All right, band, why don't you come back up? And let's just respond. There's this really beautiful song called Oceans. Oddly enough, this was on the docket the very last time we met in March. It was still on the music stands when we came in. And it's right there that we would sing. And understand, to take this in, sing it, enjoy it, worship the Lord together, okay? Okay.